The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Leader Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
At the races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, hour two, and I got to go back for a second to that amazing. Actually, I think Mig's with us, so I'll save it for Sid because that crazy filly that won the Black Eyed Susan for Shug in '96. To then look at her produce record, and there's Lady Liberty. Orbs Dam. It's funny because there was nothing else, you know, really to recommend. I mean, the mare didn't have, you know, she really was unproductive otherwise, at least with, you know, that first generation of offspring. So you look at the, you know, at what the, you know, what the produce produced, and oh, there's Orb. Richie, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. I'm sure when you realize that I had Shug on, there would be, you know, I get in the weeds with Shug because, you know, you just got to let him, you got to give him free rein.
Well, absolutely. And you know what? You're going to learn things and hear great things. And it's wonderful. This past week, I interviewed Mike Kennedy. Who galloped Seattle Slough. And, you know, we're doing a tribute piece about Billy Turner and Slough. Probably be ready by Belmont Stakes Day or Belmont Week at least. And, you want to talk about gold here in the stories. And, you know, Mike's 84 now, still sharp as a tack. And, so, I thought I knew all the stories. I heard things, Steve, that I was enraptured. It was amazing. And Ernie Munich, who shoots, works the camera and then is like the most amazing editor. He got the Eclipse Award for his Rachel Alexandra piece. I'm so excited about this and what we're going to present to the public. And again, it's one of those situations where you throw the reins at him. Let him, you know, free run. And what you're going to hear is amazing. So, you know, same with Shug, somebody like Mike Kennedy. I'm so excited, and I want to give some of the stories away, but I want to wait to see what the final edit looks like before I start doing that.
No, I'm sure. I'm sure it'll be fabulous, and I will say, I'm just reaching for a media guide. I will say this again because it came up. I don't know if it came up on air or if it came up in personal in a verbal exchange. The importance of getting those kinds of interviews recorded, and actually, it came up after. After Leon was on, after Blue was on last week, and John Nichols, Clocker John, maybe 3-4 years ago, John started to really beat the drum about doing essentially, like a Spielberg, the way Spielberg has taped Holocaust survivors, and the way Tom Hanks has done the veterans, the World War II vets, getting a video record of these kinds of stories, and it doesn't have to be, in this case, you mentioned Seattle SLU, but it can just be career reflections. But there's things that are going to be lost to posterity. We've already lost undoubtedly a lot to posterity, but we still have time. We should, whatever we can garner, we should.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we tried to do something, Mitch Levitis and I, when I was working full-time for NYRA with Alan Jerkins, and sit down and have dinners and just set up the camera and let the camera roll. We got the private room at Villa de Est. And, for several reasons, it didn't really come out the way we wanted it to. We do have some of the stories, and it's good, but it wasn't quite what we were looking for. There were some factors involved, and it just didn't 100% work out. But, acknowledging and understanding how important it is, because as these things go by the wayside and people pass on, and we're losing a piece of our history if it goes unrecorded. I understand how important it is, and to hear it directly from the person, how certain things happened and the lead up to certain things, and hearing about Onion leading up to his upset of Secretariat in the Whitney, that the fact that he broke the track record on Tuesday going 6.5 furlongs and ran back on Saturday and beat Secretariat, things like that, and the thought processes behind them. And at the heart of it all, Steve, I still am that little kid that was dying to be on that side of the fence. Like, I don't think that'll ever leave me. I walk around at Belmont, particularly now in the evening, because again, Naira was gracious enough to, give me one of the older cottages back there, so I don't have to do the commute as much. And I just think about it, and to feel the history of the place, and understand that I'm so privileged to have, witnessed a lot of it, wrote my own small little paragraph in it. I'm always going to be a fanboy, I guess. I'm always going to think about the great horses that have walked under that beautiful pine tree in the paddock, and if that tree could talk, and what we would see, and or hear, and so I get it. I mean, and I love it. I love that part of it. I think it's so important to embrace our history, because I think that gets people even more engaged. That to realize it's so much deeper than just this moment and all that came before it.
Well, and that's part of the appeal. Not that it isn't the case at Derby, but for some reason at Pimlico, because I suppose the building is is so ancient and creaking that you're just imbued with the history aspect. I mean, it just and of course I go over the top because I've got access to those photographs, and I try to get everybody excited and tuned in for that aspect. And in fact, there was one of the videos I put up. I'm trying to remember which one it is now, but I'll tell you which one it was. What year did you ride Eternal Prince in the Derby?
2002.
All right, so 2002?
Yeah. Not Eternal Prince. No, I'm sorry. I was thinking Magic Wizard. I didn't ride Eternal Prince in the Preakness. I got fired after the Derby.
That no, I know. Fun. You. I said in the Derby, 85. There you go. There, yeah.
85, yeah.
So it was whatever video I put up, is that Tanks Prospect?
Well, Tanks Prospect won the Preakness that year. Spendenbuck went wire to wire in the Derby and then didn't run back in the Preakness.
Right, and I'm trying, but give me a, now I've got to look, because now I'm forgetting. But I put up the video.
This is a great segue, by the way, after you're done with this, but this is a fantastic segue. Okay.
Well, that Gate Dancer. It was Gate Dancer's, was it Gate Dancer?
Didn't he win the 80?
That was 84.
84, yes. Yeah, yeah.
So it is Tank's prospect. I was right the first time. Because Eternal Prince was third with McCarron. But I put up the link to it, and because that was Gene Klein, Tank's prospect. Yeah. I put the link up the other day, and the video happened to be, it wasn't like a network feed, Rich. It was a, it was one of Harvey's thoroughbred action shows.
Okay.
And so he had voiced that, so he has that voiceover introduction, and then they play that chintzy music in the background. It's kind of annoying. it's silly, but, and, he mentions, Harvey mentions, he says, you know, Chris McCarron on Eternal Prince breaks sharp. Richard Migliori had ridden him in the Derby, and, you know, he's doing that voiceover, and it popped in my head. I mean, to you know, and so, anyway, here's the segue to what went on Saturday.
Right. So you know, what we see in the race now. Jockeys get probably more credit when horses win, and probably too much of the blame or criticism when horses lose.
Sure.
You know, so there's a balance there. You're working the front of the house, right? You're the person out on the front line. You're the most visible member of the human part of the team. I had flown. This is Eternal Prince's story, and I'll lead into Saturday. So Eternal Prince broke his maiden in February. As a three-year-old, ran back, I don't know, 10, 11, 12 days later, won an allowance race, ran back within 2 weeks in the Bayshore, got dusted by Pancho Villa, ran back 2 weeks later in the Gotham and blitzed them, ran back 2 weeks later in the Wood Memorial and got an easy lead and beat Proud Truth, who would eventually win the Breeders' Cup Classic. So, you know, he beat a quality field. Went to work him the Monday before the Derby in Louisville. Actually, me and Jacinto Vasquez went down together. He was working Roman Rule, I think. And Eternal Prince was an amazing workhorse. Like, you'd move a finger, Steve, and he would just grab the bit. And you had to, like, basically hold your breath and not move. And he worked terrible. He was getting out. He didn't feel good. I mean, it was too much too soon. He had packed in so much racing, and he was brilliant and so talented and gave me incredible thrill winning the Gotham, the Wood Memorial. Now he gets in the gate for the Derby. He wasn't acting right before it in the post parade. And when the infield crowd erupted, he had never seen anything like that. And he was basically shuffling his feet and cocking his head because he was distracted by the infield crowd. Boom, they kick it. I get left. I'm in trouble into the first turn. Race is over for us. Spend the Buck not only, you know, was best that day, he ran legitimate fractions. Even though Eternal Prince wasn't in there, you know, wasn't pressing him, still went 45 and change going a mile and a quarter and kept on. Ran five, you know, the mile and a quarter in 2 minutes. And, of course, I got all the criticism. And unfairly, things were said that just didn't jive with the truth, the reality. I mean, Joe Hirsch wrote that I was nervous before the race, tight as a string. He never saw me that day. He never spoke to me that day. I actually rode several horses on the undercard for Mark Cassie. Mark and I are friends. We were both young guys. And I said to him in the paddock for one of the races, I said, I'm a little confused why I'm not more nervous. I didn't feel any nerves about it whatsoever, and things didn't work out. But who got the blame? Me. And then the next day in the paper, you know, Boss fires Mig, and it was a big deal because Steinbrenner had probably just fired Billy Martin for the umpteenth time, and so much so Johnny Carson had about it in his monologue how now, you know, Steinbrenner was firing jockeys. And so anyway, you know, for a young guy, it hurt. You know, it was devastating. I mean, I went back to New York. I think I won three the next day. And, you know, you got to put it behind you and keep going. But I definitely ate a lot of crow over it. And then the horse got loose on the lead in the Preakness, finished third, beaten five and a half lengths. No excuses with McCarron. And actually, Chief's Crown should have won that race. If you go back and watch it, rest in peace. Donnie McBeth thought he had the race won. And he was kind of just you know, hand-riding and Chief's Crown's ears were up and Tank's prospect surprised in the last step with Pat Day. But they actually put me back on him in the Belmont. He should have never run in the Belmont. He was essentially eased. Walter Guerra rode him an allowance race in Saratoga, and essentially he was eased and he never ran again. So the point being that, yes, I took all the blame. I was the fall guy. But the horse was basically done by the time he got to the Derby. He had packed in too much racing, and he was just an exhausted horse at that point. Now, Saturday, Epicenter ran a tremendous race in the Derby. I thought he got a tremendous ride. I do think that he had to move a little early in the Derby into the teeth of a fast pace. But in a 20-horse field, you have to take the opportunities presented to you as they come. And so this is no, I think it was a great ride in the Derby from Joel Rosario, but in hindsight, he had to move again when the opportunities presented himself, and who, you know, an unlikely horse comes and picks him off. And when you go 21 and change the first quarter in a mile and a quarter race, it opens it up to an unlikely result. I saw something a little different than everybody else, and I have no inside knowledge of this. This is just my take on it. That horse did not push off well in the Preakness, the first step. And in fact, if you watch very closely, he lost his hind end the first step a little bit. It almost like either the ground broke away or he just wasn't really strong behind. Now, we don't know what goes on in the pit crew. We don't know what goes on in the garage between races. Right. And the trainer and the assistant and the groom and all the people that, again, the human team behind that horse, they know what's going on leading up to it. And, you know, trying to adjust their athletes, their little different things go on. He did not break like the Epicenter we've seen before, and he just did not push off strongly. And that kind of dictated what happened in the first eighth of a mile. Now, Joel Rosario is a rider that one of his gifts and one of his strengths and one of the things that make him great is he lets horses run up into his hands and get very balanced, and they use themselves very efficiently. In some respects, different styles, but some respects, a lot like Pat Day. He doesn't, you know, smack horse in the shoulder and, yeah, get up in there. He, boom, you know, take me there and do it properly. And him not pushing off as well as I've seen in the past, and there could be underlying reasons for that. Again, I have no knowledge. This is my take. Led to him basically getting squeezed about 70 yards out of the gate. And now, Joel, this is the hand I'm dealt. He gave that horse a fantastic ride after an unfortunate instant where he did get squeezed a bit. But part of it was the horse did not jump the way the horse normally jumps. He didn't push off the way. So much like I had to take all the blame for a bad break in the Derby, which happens to several horses every year in the Derby. I mean, it happened to Seattle Slough, and Kruger was bold enough to bull his way through horses and make his own space come into the wire the first time, and Seattle Slough was a monster, could do it and keep going. Joel's going to take the heat because he's the most visible member of the team, but I feel like there was something more going on here. There has to be a reason why the horse didn't push off the way he normally did. And that's my take on it. Now he's dealt this poor hand, and he played a poor hand as fine as you can, saved every inch of ground, never had a straw in his path after that, cut the corner. And let's face facts. He hooked a very, very good colt in early voting who came into this race as good as a horse can come into a race. His last two works, I was at Belmont 4, and his last one, I walked back to the barn alongside of him. And he was as primed and ready as a horse could be. And I had an inkling that they were going to sit off a horse. And the way Jose Ortiz rode him allowed Armagnac to clear him and hold his outside line, hold that five-path line. When he cleared, essentially put himself in control of the race, now stalking from the outside. And the horse showed that dimension in the morning works. Now, yes, Joel gets the blame. I think there's, you know, more going on, but people don't see, again, the most visible member of the team is going to take the hit.
Well, for starters, and I don't know if you had a chance to hear what I said in the opening segment this morning, and also on Capital OTB yesterday with Seth, I was shocked that Epicenter couldn't get to that spot that Skippy Longstocking occupied in pretty short order, and you know, whether that, you know, the start and you know, a bad first step contributed, that makes plenty of sense. But either way, at that point, Joel's got to make a decision, and there was no place really for him to go. So he starts to dive toward the rail, which he knew was good all day and all weekend, and he takes up residence. And I don't see why that is so unclear to people, and why there's this you know, this need to somehow, you know, just assume that Epicenter's a winner in this race if Joel does anything else. I mean, why not start with the winner and then work your way back? I mean, the winner was exceptional, and you could see basically they had the length of the stretch when the rail opens and when Joel, you know, gets by at that point, he's got the whole stretch, and he not only did he have the stretch, he also had the opportunity at a certain point about the 16th pole, where early voting is out in the 3.5 path probably, and probably doesn't even see Epicenter coming. And to Jose's credit, he starts to move him to the inside so that the early voting doesn't get surprised. He got beat on the square, and I don't understand why. I understand why. I'm sure, you know, Steve Asmussen and Scott and Ron Winchell and DJ Fisk and everybody, I understand why, you know, they're frustrated, but you know, there's you know, nine of them out there, and it happens. No, I totally understand.
Emotions run high. These races are so hard to win, and a horse only has one shot in their lifetime to win a Derby, to win a prize.
Right.
So you understand in the moment now. And I think, you know, Steve is a guy that is very analytical. I'm sure when, you know, he even said it right after the race. You know, Scott Hazelton had an interview with him. How, you know, a lot of emotion, got to take a step back, breathe. John Kimmel's one of my dearest friends. I mean, we're close. We're like brothers. You know, we went through a lot together, worked very closely with him in the barn. The success we had together didn't happen by accident. You know, I was in the barn every day. I'd go to Fairhill and work the babies. He and I would talk about the horses and the next steps and, you know, what we needed to do to give them their opportunity to be the best they could. And in some respects, I was not just his rider. I was kind of a player coach, if you will. Like I would consider myself almost one of the assistants, the way we would approach things. And after a big race, a very high-profile race, I'm not going to go into all the gory details, he slammed me in the press. Emotions were high. It was in the heat of the moment. It came out in the racing form, his honestly unfair criticism of my ride and the circumstances. And I went into his office the day after I read it, Steve, fully prepared to never ride for him again. And I closed the door, and I let loose. And how dare you, as hard as I work for you and as much as I'm involved in this team and part of the preparation of these horses, slam me in the press. If you don't like one of my effing rides and you've got a problem with the way I rode a horse, you be man enough to sit here in this office face-to-face and you tell me that, not the press. And I went off. And, you know, he was taken aback because I went in aggressive and honestly fully prepared to say, you know, take your horses, your barn, everything else, and stick them. And he thought about it a minute. He goes, it's the heat of the moment. I should have took a breath. You're 1,000,000% right. I'm sorry. And eventually we hugged it out. It put it behind us. So things you say sometimes in the heat of the moment is emotion, you know, and we all do it. I've done it. Hell, do it in your marriage. Do it. It's part of the relationships. In hindsight, and, you know, you would always wish that you'd give yourself that moment or that day to breathe and let it kind of settle in before you react to whatever just happened. We're human. We're all human. I do think, though, that Joel's getting unfairly criticized. And let me ask you a question now. Let's say he was able to get up in between Pippi Longstocking, whatever the horse's name is, Skippy Longstocking, and have that spot. Now he's probably laying fifth, strung out 3-4 wide the entire first turn. And then he's going to be criticized for, well, such a good rail that day, and he didn't break great. Now he rushed up to, you know, be chasing wide, right? So you can't win unless you win. I mean, ultimately, that's the story. I think after, yes, was he compromised? 100%. In a perfect world, the horse breaks better, and maybe he's in a better position. And I personally think he ran into a colt that's very, very good, that was extremely good going into the race. Chad Brown did an amazing job, and you could see the way they worked him. They wanted to test him in the morning to see if he'd be amenable to stalking a horse, which obviously he was. That professionalism, showing that versatility, makes a horse doubly dangerous. But after that, he played the hand perfectly, considering that, yes, he was admittedly, I believe, somewhat compromised the first 16th of a mile, but what else can you ask for after that? He saved every inch of ground, never left the fence, never steadied, never missed any forward progress from that point on. I think people have to be a little bit more realistic about how they watch a race and really the inner workings of everything.
Well, I had to, you know, we had to address this, and it will be interesting to see what comes out of, you know, the postscript on that front. Now that you introduce a experience of your own, because there was a lot of speculation, and having reached out to Ron Anderson, I saw Ron actually at spent a couple minutes with him and Tim Yakteen on Friday, but.
Noel's too good a rider.
Exactly.
A Hall of Fame trainer, one of the greatest trainers in racing history. He rode. I think you give anybody a pass if your emotions running a bit high in the heat of a moment. But when you have an opportunity to reflect and look at the whole picture, I have a hard time seeing Joel Rosario not continuing to be a part of that team. I don't believe that'll be the case. And, everybody's, and I'm not talking about the people directly involved, people on social media and people that, watch and bet on races are very good armchair quarterbacks or, armchair jockeys. It's not easy, but at the same time, you're a professional and you're in the public eye. So you've got to be strong enough, and I think Joel is, to be able to handle the criticisms. It's just, it comes with the territory. Like I said, when it happened to me at 20 years old with Eternal Prince, it was hard to take, and I needed to figure out how to put it behind me. The one that stung the most was Joe Hirsch being critical, or saying something that just was patently untrue. And when somebody of that stature in the industry says something, it's automatically fact, even though it couldn't have been further from fact. And that one stung, and I actually had a conversation with Joe about it, and he said, "Oh, well, somebody told me that," and it was, to me, irresponsible journalism. And he said he'd make it up to me, but that wasn't the case. But anyway, life goes on.
A couple of things about, and I think Jose Ortiz is going to join us tomorrow, and there was a lot to admire about the way Chad Brown and Seth Klarman planned this and executed this win with early voting. When it comes to Jose, Rich, there was something that Chad said Saturday in the press conference that was very notable, how Jose handled the situation. And this gets back to what you just referenced quite a bit. There was a point where Zandon and early voting were going to have to run on the same day in different races, and Chad's preference was for Jose to stay with early voting, and he didn't complain, he didn't grouse, he said yes, boss, and went on. And you could see you could see how emotional Jose got post race, and how much it meant to him. I think that you know, in terms of big days, I mean, he just distinguishes himself every big Saturday.
Yeah, I feel like he raises his game when it's a big race day. You know, Irad's more of every day, every race is the Kentucky Derby. You watch him ride a 62.5 claimer at Gulfstream in the winter or a Grade One, and he rides with the same kind of ferocity, intensity. Where Jose rides well all the time, but it seems like game day, big game day, his game certainly, you know, reaches another level. First, let's talk about the emotion. You know, I had the privilege of interviewing him yesterday, and he said something. He goes, you know, you hit have these big moments in like a huge prestigious race like the Preakness, and you kind of go through in your mind the Rolodex of things it took to get here. And I'm sure, you know, it goes back to the beginning when you're accepted into the jockey school in Puerto Rico, and all the stalls you mucked and all the horses you groomed and the horses you let out with the class in front of you that was getting to ride, and you're, you know, dying to get that opportunity to be on that horse's back. And then it comes your turn, and Manny Franco's leading you out because he's in the class behind you. And all of the hard work and all of the setbacks along the way, that's where that emotion comes from. To me, it happened my first win back after that terrible accident in 88, out 7 months, come back, I'm in front, realizing I'm going to win, and it was like freeze frames of every moment and every struggle to get back to riding after that action. I started crying from the eighth pole of the wire. I'm crying. My goggles are fogged up, pulled up, because it's like you see these little frames of everything it takes to get to that point, whether it's an emotional win like coming back from an injury, or an emotional win by winning a Preakness. And you know, you could see how much it means. And I thought that was beautiful because it was so pure and so raw. And, you know, we don't get to see that all the time. So I was really appreciative of that. And now the thing with Zandon and early voting, you know what it was reminiscent of for me, because I love reading about the history and stuff. Eddie Arcaro was the first call rider for Calumet. And Ben Jones said to him he wanted to ride Coaltown in the Derby. Coaltown was this fast horse, was a streak. And Ben Jones says, no, you're going to ride Citation. And he and Arcaro had a conversation about it, and he said, Eddie, listen to me. You're going to ride Citation. Citation wins a Triple Crown. Coaltown was five in front of him at one point in the Derby, and Arcaro was worried about reeling him in, but he trusted the boss. Do what, you know, and that's the situation you're in. And if you think about the three-year-olds that Chad Brown has, and, you know, Zandon, early voting, a classic winner, and maybe the best one of all, Jack Christopher, right? I mean, he's holding a very strong hand in the three-year-old. Guess what? If I'm in a position to ride for the guy, who do you want me to ride, boss? That's the right answer right there.
Well, Chad specifically wanted that out there as part of the, you know, as part of the narrative of how, you know, this came about. And also I thought, we'll probably have Chad tomorrow, I think. And, you know, the way he said that there was no benefit to taking that horse to the Derby, you know, he kept monitoring the pace, and it turned out the pace was even faster than anticipated. And he said, you don't want to take a horse with three starts. And this is in the weeks leading up to Derby. That's all anybody talked about, was how much inexperience, you know, Taba particularly had, and, you know, some of the lightly raced other players in Derby. And, you know, then 2 weeks later, you would think that there would have been even more appreciation for the way they approach this, and acknowledge that there was more to gain by bypassing Derby than there was to participate. And they're rewarded, you know, on that front for the second time, actually, when you fold in cloud computing. So the
20 horse field, you know, and always too fast a pace for the distance. Even when we've said, oh, wasn't that fast the pace? Well, maybe it wasn't that fast the pace for the Derby, but for a mile and a quarter, it's always at very least of legitimate pace and usually faster than normal. And this year it was, you know, back to that whole other level, song and a prayer level, right? And in a 20-horse field, you're throwing something at horses that they're not going to see again, not in North America. And you need foundation. You need that experience. I probably sound like a broken record. They knew Mike Tyson was going to be champion of the world when he was 15 years old, and he still fought 20 tune-up fights before they started putting him in with guys that were legit.
Well, every time they line up in a classic race, the fields are legit. Whoever wins these, everybody's wringing their hands and carrying on about the spacing and about the elements of these three races. To me, there's something special about it the way it is, and it doesn't need adjusting. If you want to force an issue, go back to adding a bonus structure again, the Visa Triple Crown. I mean, just the fact that we still call it the Visa Triple Crown, it shows you how valuable the marketing concept was of the point system that they created for that period.
Well, there was only one flaw with that, though, Steve, is that you had to compete in all three, and I think that was the flaw in it.
They can change that.
Well, that's the only thing that needs to be changed. I agree. I think that a bonus system would be fabulous and would help the series, but you can't mandate horses to run and put out that carrot out there, if you will. The other night I walked to Poppy's and had dinner in Floral Park, and guy at the bar decided he was going to impress me with his racing acumen and started, getting very, belligerent that, horses should have to run in all three. That's ridiculous. How the Derby winner's not running back in the Preakness, and now, a fresh horse that didn't run in the Derby wins the Preakness, and they're ruining the game. These horses have to run in all three or not run in any at all. And I said, think about what you're saying. This is flesh and bone here. They're animals. If a horse isn't 100% physically or mentally or just tired, you think they should be forced to run? I mean, that's the most absurd thing I've ever heard. Couldn't change this guy's mind. He knew more about racing than me and horses than me. So, I applaud connections that listen to their horses. And it's something I've always said. There's no such thing as a horse whisperer. There are horse listeners. And a horse will tell you everything you need to know if you're paying attention. These people training these horses are at the highest level. And they're going to assess what their horse is telling them and plan accordingly, not make the horse fit the program or the plan they're putting in place. And that's horsemanship. That's the crux of it right there. So, I applaud Eric Reed for saying, hey, this isn't right for my horse, and I'll see you at the Belmont. That takes a lot of fortitude. I'm sure the temptation was great to try to continue on this path and go to the Preakness. And then, like with Tabor, they went on to the Derby. The temptation was great. Chad Brown, Seth Klarman looked at it and said, not right for this horse. We'll try the Preakness if he's good, and they did, and they were rewarded. What's wrong with winning a classic? I mean, these races are so hard to win. People go lifetimes chasing them, and then people are going to get knocked because, they didn't take on the Derby. Yeah, please, give me a break.
The odd thing, and really it's going to have to fall to, to the Maryland Jockey Club to actively recruit. I said this with Seth yesterday, and I'm not trying to pick on the Pletcher barn, but I mean, honestly, how is there not a Pletcher? There wasn't anybody from, there wasn't one 3-year-old in that barn that to bring forward?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know. You know, it's a very good question. You know, and in years past, like Todd runs horses in the Derby that they don't win. They're, you know, you're not really going to see them back in the Preakness in 2 weeks.
So, I understand.
And I don't believe in this nonsense about changing. You know, I mean, we hear this. I've heard this since I was a kid. You know, I remember before Secretariat 25 years, people were clamoring that they had to, you know, change it and give them more time.
Yep.
And then we had three Triple Crown winners in the 70s, and people were clamoring that they got to make it tougher. So, you know, it is what it is. It's supposed to be hard, and that's why it's not done with a lot of frequency, because it takes a special kind of horse, and everything's got to fall right, and it's the hard that makes it great.
The three, you talk about the 70s, and reality is that by all rights, Little Current was easily worthy of a Triple Crown win, and they limited the starting gate after you know, he was denied a Triple Crown. Churchill limited to 20 after that, and of course, Spectacular Bid. You could have had five of them in the 70s.
You easily could have had five in the 70s. And man, you know, you bring up Little Current, and he got some spectacular rides from Mike Rivera. Miguel Rivera gave that horse in the Preakness and the Belmont spectacular rides. And Spectacular Bid, you know, listen, I love going back and looking at stuff, and I have a lot of access because we had the vault at Aqueduct that we have basically everything. But you can go back, watch. I'll tell your listeners, go to YouTube, put in the 1979 Florida Derby, and it'll come up. Jim McKay and Eddie R. Carroll walk you through the race. You want to see a performance that only a horse, a super horse, could win the race, let alone win by open lengths after the trip and the ride he got from Ronnie Franklin. And then he chased a horse named Gallant Best in the Belmont, and maybe it was overconfidence that they just thought he was going to pull a Secretariat. I mean, they talked about him in those reverent tones. And I, frankly, never gave Spectacular Bid the credit he was due, because I, you know, as a kid, I was the guy who didn't like Muhammad Ali because he talked, so I rooted for Joe Frazier. I didn't like Joe Namath because he was always yapping. I'd rather go with Johnny Unitas, right? So them always talking about him being the greatest horse to look through a bridle just turned me off as a kid. Now, I'm an old man now, and I love Muhammad Ali and have a better understanding of the human being and his principles. Joe Namath, a whole different appreciation, and certainly I'm a huge Spectacular Bid fan. But go to YouTube and watch that Florida Derby. Watch his Preakness when Screen King and Angels got him out in the 18 path, and because there was no way Ronnie Franklin was going to go inside Angel. He was so intimidated. And then the Belmont chasing Gallant Best, you know, and Coastal was very good too. You know, I hate when horses get lost in the shuffle. Coastal was a very good racehorse that David Whiteley had primed to the moment after winning the Peter Pan.
While they're doing the video search, and if you're going to go into the rabbit hole, I kept promising and I didn't get to it. And now that it came up again, I should put up back to back. I'll put up the Little Current, Preakness, and Belmont. Maybe you should watch the Derby too, and you see the trouble that he gets into. But then Rivera up the rail in the Preakness is unbelievable, and he with every stride he puts more and more distance between him and the field chasing him. Underrated, underappreciated dual classic winner in Little Current, undoubtedly. Richie, this was fabulous. I'm going to put up since we talked about 85, I found a picture of you from 85 in the Naira Media Guide. We're going to put that up today.
Oh, great. I'll look at that and I'll feel even older than I am.
Actually, you look the same. That's the amazing thing.
Yeah, I wish. At least I felt the same, Steve.
Rich Migliore, everybody. Mig 4450. And Richie, we're edging closer edging closer to getting down there for Belmont Week. I'm looking forward to it. Haven't been down much. Wasn't down this much this winter. Just once, actually. And so looking forward to a big week. It'll be a good Belmont.
Exactly. We have to 100% at least one dinner, all of us, and we'll have a good time. Steve, have a great day.
Rich Migliore, everybody. We're going to take the break here rather than get started with State and Fleury. Let's take the break. We'll come back for hour three. State and Fleury is going to join us, and Johnny D will get Johnny's take on the weekend. And Johnny had the right approach. He was concentrated on Epicenter, but the way he structured the hierarchy was right. With creative minister and the Philly. So it didn't have sort of a backup plan with early voting on top, only early voting second under Epicenter. But the concept valuable to remember as you handicap and structure your bets. That part was invaluable again this weekend. Back after this, though, State and Fleury joins us to celebrate the win in the Black-Eyed Susan Interstate Daydream, the classic Empire Philly, and another good Philly for the State and Fleury barn. Back after this.
Who you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Pons family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and currently stands the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning. Learn more at CountryLifeFarm.com.
Horsemen, nominate now for the $400,000 Grade II Penn Mile and the $150,000 Penn Elks. Both races will be run Friday, June 3rd, each at 1 mile on the grass at Hollywood Casino at Penn National Racecourse. Nominations close Wednesday, May 18th. Contact the Penn National Racing Office at 1-800-233-8238. That's 1-800-233-8238. Or go to HollywoodPNRC.com/racing.
Your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals. With a